This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Dutch-born artist M.C. Escher was a creative genius who is probably best known for his impossible constructions that are featured on many dorm room posters and coffee table books. Ironically enough, Escher never really was interested in fame. He once refused a request from Mick Jagger for a commissioned album cover, and he seemed to prefer to rub elbows with mathematicians and spend time meticulously crafting his work. A collection of more than 130 pieces is currently on view at the North Carolina Museum of Art. The exhibit, The Worlds of M.C. Escher, surveys the entirety of his career, from his earliest print to the last. And we'll get a special preview today in our studio. Joining me is the exhibit's curator, David Steele. He's curator of European art at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome, David. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Meryl Schatzman. She's a printmaker and a professor of the practice of visual art at Duke. Welcome, Meryl.
Welcome. Thanks.
Good to have you here. And Karen Daniels is with us, a professor of physics at NC State. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. David, let me start with you. Tell us more about M.C. Escher, his background.
He was born in 1898. His father was an engineer, and he had four brothers, and a couple of them were engineers. Another one was a crystallographer and professor of geology. So he grew up in a kind of science engineering background. He went off to school and met a printmaker, and he had drawn a lot as a child, but I think that meeting with a printmaker changed his life, changed, I think, actually the course of modern culture.
Yeah, he was an aspiring architect, right?
He was. He actually had a little trouble with math at school. And I think that was one of the things that drove him into the arts.
It's fascinating when you think about how mathematicians and scientists have come to embrace his work, that he had trouble with math.
Yeah, actually, the first people who collected his works were mathematicians and scientists.
And he was deeply into drawing. Tell us about his early career.
Well, he and a couple of buddies took a road trip to Italy, a train trip to Italy. And they spent about 5 weeks seeing all of northern Italy, Florence, Venice, Tuscany. And then he went back to Holland, and he'd made 200 drawings, and he was intending to turn those into prints. And after he got back to Holland, which is flat and rainy and the weather wasn't so great, he only made one print, and then he decided he had to go back to Italy, and he spent the next 13 years in Italy.
I would do that, too. And those early prints, which are on display at the North Carolina Museum of Art, don't exhibit the kind of thing that we think of when we think of Escher, that kind of optical illusion that he creates. These are pretty much straightforward, lovely, lovely sketches and drawings, right?
Right. I wanted to include the early works because in a lot of shows you only see the later works that a lot of people know. And I wanted to show that these early works show that he's a very keen observer of nature. And at the same time, he's perfecting his craft. And he is a master craftsman. And I hope that as people go through the show, they will just appreciate these beautiful works, because we're so used to seeing Escher in books. Yeah. And it's not the same at all when you see them face-to-face.
Or on dorm room walls.
Or at blacklight posters, yeah.
Exactly. Well, Meryl Schatzman, tell us more about his evolution then as he became a printmaker.
His work spanned from doing woodcuts to wood engravings to lithographs. And much of his work initially started out doing landscapes. He also did some work with some portraits. He started to do work that also had a lot of architecture in it. And eventually, he started to do work that encompassed using architecture and using architecture with puzzles and, in a sense, combining those puzzles with images that would, in a sense, make a metamorphosis that would change and evolve into something else. One of the most striking images in the show is the metamorphosis image that is compromises, I think, 29 blocks, that is at least 20 feet long, and goes from both realism to very plain abstract images, and then goes back to realism. And he continually sways back and forth between both realistic images and abstract images, and kind of swings the viewer back and forth with this type of narrative. He also does a lot of tessellation images and really kind of continually gives the viewer lots of puzzles to kind of try and figure out as they visit the exhibit.
As a printmaker yourself, when you look at his early work and his early sketches, is there any evidence in that early work that this is the kind of thing he's going to gravitate toward? I mean, it's unique, and certainly in his moment in history, I think, you know, he's not imitating anybody at that point, right?
No, he isn't. I think the complexity of his marks potentially could lead on to the complexity of the work that he does. The marks that he uses are so intricate, and they are...
When you talk about... Forgive me for interrupting.
Sure.
But so when you talk about a mark, are you talking about the way he kind of makes the way the lines...
The way that the lines are cut.
Okay.
When he's making a woodcut, he's using certain types of tools that will cut the marks in certain ways. They're called gouges, and some will make a very thin mark, some will make thicker marks. When he's making a wood engraving, he'll be using a burin, and that will make a different kind of mark. When he's making a lithograph, he's using probably a lithographic crayon or pencil, and although there are no lines that are indicated, it's more through tone, those pencils are kind of giving a variety of different types of tones. But primarily in the wood cuts, you're getting different types of marks, and the complexity of and the variety of those types of marks are showing down the line the complexity of the prints that you might be getting. Now, granted, when you're seeing the marks, it has to do with how close those marks are to each other, because marks cannot show tone, so that when you are placing marks close to each other, they may look gray. When they're further apart, then they will look black, so that when you are looking at the prints down the line, you're going to look at larger black spaces that might look like a shape, but then you'll have lots of closer marks that will look as if they're very complex forms or different types of marks alluding to the space that he is trying to show.
That's fascinating, because what you've done there is give us a glimpse into his imagination, how he's seeing the world as this kind of metamorphizing universe in front of him, but also the craftsmanship that he displays. And he is meticulous in his work. He does many, many drafts before he gets to the finished product, right?
Yes. And frankly, I think very rarely would he leave his studio until he had gotten his print absolutely perfect. I mean, there is a level of perfectionism that goes along with his work that one very rarely sees, you know, I mean, just almost machine-like in a sense.
David, as curator, do you have an insight into what that perfection meant to him? Was it a kind of craftsmanship that could create these amazing, I'll call them illusions, or was there something else going on in terms of what he was trying to convey, his message, if he were a perfectionist?
I think almost all great artists have an idea in their mind what they want to put on paper. With a printmaker, it's a little bit more complicated because you have to think in reverse. It's not like a painter where there are lots of different colors, there are lots of different brushes you can use. I think that with Escher, as I walk through the show, he lived in very tumultuous times. He lived through two world wars where the wars were actually happening. And I think for him, his art, his perfectionism was a way for him to bring order into a world that he saw as chaotic. And you can see his craftsmanship evolving and becoming more and more sophisticated. When I walk through and I'm taking people around and they say, well, how did he do that? And I say, I don't know how he did that. You know, he had an idea of what he wanted to do, and he set himself the task of doing it. Even a lot of these prints, when you look at them in a book, they're just there. And what you don't realize is sometimes there are 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 preparatory sketches in order to get it right. Yeah. And that holds true with the illusionistic architecture. He called those later illusions brain games, and he wanted to, he said to make them that first of all the artist has to fool himself, and then he has to fool the viewer, so that when you see it initially, you think, oh, okay, it's real, but then the illusion reveals itself the more time you spend looking at the print.
Well, Karen Daniels, it was also a tumultuous time. You're a physicist, and in science, things were changing quickly as well. And scientists came to embrace his work, and he felt very at home with science. Tell us about his relationship, his work to math and science.
Well, as David said earlier, in fact, he was not a trained mathematician. He considered himself bad at math. And I think probably what he might have meant by that was bad at calculations and algebra, which, of course, are only one small part of mathematics. And the part of mathematics that many physicists and mathematicians find attractive in his work is his representations of rotations and symmetries and reflections, which are mathematical objects to us that we manipulate, and understanding how the different pieces fit together to give something fourfold symmetry or sixfold symmetry is how we understand crystallography and how different materials get their properties. And so his illustrations of those very much help us understand what are for us maybe things that are more difficult to visualize. We can calculate perhaps more easily than we can visualize them. And so I would say he's a very good mathematician in that sense.
In conceptualizing it and seeing kind of what this stuff looks like, because again, when you describe some of the complex physical and scientific concepts that are emerging in the 20th century, it's pretty hard to get our head around some of these concepts. Well, and there is a print called Relativity, right?
There is, in fact, and it doesn't really represent what Einstein meant by relativity, although relativity shows up lots of places in physics besides the big one that we all know. What I love about that print is that each person in the print who's walking on their own staircase is perfectly happy.
Maybe we should describe it.
This is a print that has three staircases going around in a circle to make these, you know, Penrose triangles that he loved so much in some sense. And there's a series of people who, if you look at only one corner of the picture, they look like they have walls and doors and staircases and carrying buckets of water, and their gravity points down towards their feet. And it's completely, you know, unbizarre.
Right.
And then if you try to scan your eyes across the other sides, other parts of the page, what you see is that somebody else has a different version of reality. And I think this is why he entitled it Relativity,
right.
Is that the viewpoint of the observer is not absolute.
Right. So it all makes sense in every quadrant. But when you put it all together, you think, well, if that's true, then that can't be true.
You have to turn the print 90 degrees clockwise to see gravity world number two. And then you would turn it 90 degrees counterclockwise from its original orientation to see gravity world number three.
So, David, did he like to hang out with scientists?
His brother was a crystallographer.
Yeah.
So
it's clear those connections.
He was
are there.
Very comfortable there, and some of his closest friends were mathematicians and, interestingly enough, classical musicians. And so I think that he got some of his ideas from those people. There's one print called Circle Limit 3 where he's working with a mathematician named Coxeter, who is a very famous geometer in his own day. And so he sends this print off. He's very proud and inscribes it. And we actually have that print in the show. And he sends it off to Coxeter, and he writes his son. He says, well, Coxeter really liked the print. He wrote me three pages explaining what I had done. He said, unfortunately, I didn't understand a word he said.
Also, Karen, you talked about the connection to music. And when I look at Escher and I think of the Mobius strip as kind of the other example of this sort of illusion, and then what I think I know about Baroque music comes to mind, this kind of circle of fifths where there's an illusion that the music keeps going up a tone. But, of course, ultimately it would go out of range, so that can't be happening.
Right, and this is very much like the picture he has of another staircase that's impossible for the reason that every person on the staircase is walking uphill, and yet they come back in the other side. He has a lot of these circular illusions. The ants on the Mobius strip is another one. These actually have wonderful representations, again, of physics quantities. An electron, for instance, has a property we call spin 1/2, and that means you have to rotate it twice to get it to come back to its original orientation, which is not like a coffee cup, which you rotate once and it comes back to its orientation. And so he actually has drawn worlds that are spin 1/2 where we have trouble imagining how an electron lives like that.
Well, Merrill, tell us about you. I know you and Karen both have looked at some of his letters. David, I'm sure you have. How have they, his letters, informed your understanding, Merrill, of his work?
They have informed me in how he thinks, primarily, you know, in his working process. He would isolate himself and go into his studio for long periods of time and would think a lot about what he wanted to do and try and make the connection between the idea in his brain and the idea that he would put down on the piece of paper. He would work tirelessly at creating that image and potentially go through a number of different images. And once getting close, he would leave, you know, kind of come out of the room, and it could be days until he, you know, got to that point. And then at one point, he would feel very content and let his hands take over and let his hands then carve the image or, you know, draw the image or whatever process that he would be using. And I could very easily understand that. And you know, when I would be making an image and how unsettled I would be until I could get it right. And so I think most artists go through that process when they are thinking about what they're doing. And most of his letters were really a wonderful connection about his everyday thoughts with his family or just how, you know, he would think about his art. He would very, very rarely show his work until he finished it. So that he did not leave it open for criticism until he had gotten it to that stage.
And when it did, it became wildly popular, so much so that people like Mick Jagger, for one, asked him to do album art. And certainly he was very popular in as we say, dorm rooms and everything. Still today. I mean, he's a pop culture icon. And yet he rejected all of that, apparently, David.
Right, right. Well, he... Mick Jagger writes this letter and says, "Dear Moritz, we'd like you to design an album cover." And Escher writes back politely and says, "No, I'm not really interested in that." And then at the bottom, he writes, "P.S. Please tell Mr. Jagger that I'm not Moritz to him. I am Mr. M.C. Escher." And even the black light posters, which you could argue, at least for me and for people of my generation, that's where we first got to know Escher. Yeah. And yet he complains bitterly in letters that the hippies of San Francisco are ruining my art and reproducing it. So,
why? It's like Jack Kerouac, who hippies used to show up at his door. He wanted to blast him because he was a very patriotic guy who said that you don't understand my book at all if you're here with that stuff.
I wonder what he would make now. You know, a print like Relativity, it shows up in The Simpsons and then Family. Matt Groening is a big fan, and it shows up those moving staircases in the Harry Potter movies, even in more contemporary films like Inception or Night at the Museum 3 or a movie from the 80s called Labyrinth, where the last scene is they're running through a relativity.
Right. Well, whatever he would make of our use of his art and our understanding, we have embraced it. What accounts for his continued popularity, do you think, David?
I think that he's working with recognizable subjects, even if they're imaginary or not, so that we feel that initial connection. The other thing I think that is wonderful is that his work repays attention. And so you may come to a work of art and say, "Oh, well, okay." And then you look a little more carefully and you say, "Uh-oh, you know, oh my gosh, how did he do that?" And you look more carefully and you start to notice things. And I've really come to realize that he's doing it deliberately. In that Metamorphosis print, it ends with a chess board. And if you look at the way the chess pieces are set up, an artist might regularly just arrange the chess pieces in a way that's pleasing to the eye. But when you look at it, you see that Escher wants you to think, okay, here's the move. What's the next move? What's the next move after that? And there's something there.
You've already spent a lot of time going through this.
Absolutely.
Thing, now you're playing chess. Fascinating stuff. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. David Steele is the curator of European art at the North Carolina Museum of Art and also the curator of the M.C. Escher exhibit. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Merrill Schatzman is a printmaker and a professor of the practice of visual art at Duke. Thanks, Merrill.
Thank you.
And Karen Daniels, a professor of physics at NC State. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you very much.
The exhibit, The Worlds of M.C. Escher, is on view at the North Carolina Museum of Art through January 17th, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. More music and art and science together when the Duke Medicine Orchestra joins us in just a moment. Please stay tuned.